This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Scott Jagow, and I'm here to make sense of what happened this week in business and the economy. It's Friday, July 17th. There's a term used in the environmental movement, greenwashing, which describes companies that say they're being green, but in fact, if you dig a little deeper, there's not much substance there. It's like slapping new paint on a rickety fence or putting lipstick on a pig. You pick your cliche. But as I look back on this week, that kind of activity seemed to be pervasive. And I'm not just talking about the environment. There's greenwashing in the financial industry, too. What else would you call banks buying toxic assets, repackaging them, and putting them back on the market as if they were something new and better? The ratings agencies should have scraped off the top coat of paint on the original loan bundles instead of just looking at the shiny parts and calling the whole thing AAA. We found out this week that could come back to bite them. And how about those bank profits? They sure looked good, but what's lurking underneath? Well, it depends on the bank, and we'll explain why. GM got started on rebranding itself, but from what we've heard so far, it's fair to ask, is GM just doing a paint job on a rusty car? And then there was a potential case of greenwashing in the environmental sense. You know what? I better go grab my painting clothes. This could get messy. Ain't no color paint gonna cover the stains, but if the oxygen escapes, it'll smother the flames. No introduction, doesn't speak his own name. Gonna beat them demons at their own game.
Marketplace, providing you what you need to know about business and economics on air and online. Explore everything Marketplace has to offer, from explainers on technical terms to stories on personal finance at marketplace.org.
I think we'll start with CIT. It was a name you probably heard all week, even if you never heard it before now. CIT is a lender that specializes in small and medium-sized businesses. Despite that fact, it proclaimed this week that it was too big to fail. A little background, CIT did get $2 billion of TARP money a few months ago. Let's hear more about this from Steve Henn.
David Marcantonio is a commercial loan broker in Connecticut. His state has lost roughly 4,000 small businesses this year, often because they had trouble getting financing. And Marcantonio says CIT was traditionally a lender of last resort.
Usually if someone goes into a bank and there's something and the bank says, gee, we can't help you, then the next stop after that is CIT.
Bill Dunkelberg is chief economist at the National Federation of Independent Business. He says unlike traditional banks, CIT doesn't raise most of its money from depositors with savings accounts. Instead, it gets its cash on Wall Street from investors.
And they use that to finance the loans that they make to small businesses for longer term.
As the recession dragged on, many of its small business loans have gone bad, and investors are getting nervous.
And of course, if investors become unwilling to lend to CIT, then it can't support the small business loans.
Marcantonio fears if CIT collapses, it would create a domino effect on Main Street as small businesses close down or pare back and lay off workers.
Of course, nobody wants to see that happen. But how much of this is CIT painting a disastrous picture of the future? And how much of it is reality? Jeremy Hobson talked to Edward Altman, a finance professor at NYU's Stern School of Business.
This is not, in my opinion, a systemic risk issue, and I don't think they should be bailed out. But that doesn't mean that they won't be.
Altman says the bar has been lowered for too big to fail. The new standard appears to be big enough to be annoying. And he says CIT is nothing like Lehman Brothers, the one bank that the government did allow to collapse, a decision many now regret.
I don't see how this company is going to be saved in the long run, which was not the case for Lehman. Lehman just had just too much debt and not enough friends out there, whereas CIT has a business model problem, which Lehman did not.
I think there's a lot of political pressure to finally not rescue one, but this would be a difficult first case.
That's Karen Petru, Managing Director of Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. She says a bailout of CIT would mean the government is doubling down on a bet it made months ago.
But so far, the government has said no, we're not putting any more money into CIT. So we may find out what happens when a lender like that fails. Another name we heard a lot this week was Goldman Sachs. Can't tell you how many columns I read about the giant vampire squid, or the evil empire, whatever name you want to use. Goldman reported more than $3 billion in profit for the last quarter. It's quite a turnaround. Hardly surprising, though, when you understand what's going on here. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains it.
It turns out what happens when the financial system crashes is a lot like what happens when a computer program crashes. Who are you going to call? You're likely to end up paying the same people you're cursing for the technical support to maneuver your way out of the mess. As Manhattan College finance professor Charles Geist sees it, that's what's behind all the money Goldman Sachs is raking in now.
They have a reputation for hiring the best and the brightest people on Wall Street. And when times like this arise and the crunch comes, one needs that sort of expertise to dig one's way out. So in other words, they find themselves on all sides of the market and all sides of the crisis, and they're benefiting from it.
Businesses have been flocking to Goldman for loans and for help issuing stock to raise much-needed funding. And the firm's high-tech split-second trading systems have made a fortune. It's been able to cash in on volatility in oil and other commodities and the stock market. Geist finds irony in Goldman's fast footwork paying back the rescue money it got from the government's troubled asset relief program. That means taxpayers aren't seeing much benefit from their $10 billion largesse.
It's sort of difficult to say whether or not the TARP money actually provided the capital that they needed for these activities. My guess is yes, it did.
If your blood pressure is rising, I suggest maybe you take a break and come back to me in a few minutes, because this next story isn't going to relax you. As I said at the beginning of the podcast, banks are buying up toxic assets, repackaging them, and then putting them back on the market as if they're something new and better. Morgan Stanley is doing this, for example. Kai Rizdahl talked to Bob Moon, who always has a creative way of explaining things.
This is something called a credit loan obligation, or a CLO. They've taken a bunch of loans made by businesses, just like those mortgage-backed securities that we've talked so much about. This bundle of loans is supposed to provide a solid, steady payout over time. Now, these loans were once rated AAA, the best quality investment that money can buy. But not too long ago, this bundle got downgraded by an investment rating agency. So Morgan Stanley is repackaging these loans, and it thinks it can pull it off and come up with a AAA rating once again.
This is the help me understand part. How can something be AAA, get downgraded, and now be repackaged to AAA again?
Well, I brought my blender in.
I'm sorry, what?
I brought my blender in
okay.
to demonstrate how this happens. We've got a big bowl of strawberries here, and you'll notice that most of them are nice and fresh. Okay. The stuff on the bottom is, shall we say, a little mushy. Okay. As far as I can tell, there's no mold, though. So let's just throw in some of these strawberries here and... We'll get the blender going.
All right.
Make a little smoothie
Careful
here.
Now.
Okay, here we go. Hey, looks pretty good. Huh?
It looks good, yes.
Now, we want to let this settle a little bit before we drink it so the bad stuff can sink to the bottom, because we're going to skim the good stuff off the top, and that ought to be grade A.
Your analogy, then, is the bad strawberries are the gunky loans, and the AAA stuff is good, and by blending it, we make the whole thing AAA, yes?
That's right.
I can't drink that, though. I can't buy the whole bond without getting sick.
Well, that's where the critics come in. I spoke to Robert Kuttner. He's an economist and editor of American Prospect. And he says as long as there's no reform, bankers are going to keep trying to feed us this stuff. They're going to try to find ways to reintroduce toxic stuff back into the system.
I mean, when you think about the effrontery of playing the same game and you, through some alchemy, sprinkle holy water on it and it turns into a AAA security and you find somebody who's foolish enough to buy it, that's the first thing they ought to reform.
Two words, Bob. Rating agencies. Aren't they supposed to protect us?
Well, I spoke to Moody's today. They say they haven't rated this particular deal, but apparently Morgan Stanley plans to go to Moody's and seek a rating. Now, keep in mind, that would mean Morgan would be paying Moody's for the rating. And the critics say that's the problem here. There's a conflict of interest. The Obama administration hasn't yet addressed that question. It's apparently a little too complex to come up with a quick answer, so it's on the back burner for now.
But probably not for long. This week, the country's biggest public pension fund sued the rating agencies for being wildly inaccurate with their ratings on certain investments. The California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, sunk a ton of money into these bundles of loans that were rated AAA. That's the top rating. But these things turned out to be piles of garbage. Banking professor Joseph Mason says CalPERS has a case.
This is not a free market. By regulation, CalPERS can only purchase investments that are rated BBB or better. But the government regulations that require that don't define what BBB means or what AAA means for that matter. It's kind of like the government saying you have to buy this particular newspaper and abide by their opinions, but the newspaper has no responsibility whatsoever to report anything near the truth.
But management consultant Peter Cohen says CalPERS is by no means purely a victim here.
CalPERS, which presumably has professional investment analysts deciding where to put the money, apparently chose not to care what they were investing in. Instead, what they decided to do was, oh, this is AAA rated, no problem, we'll buy it. They put $1.6 billion into it in 2006, and by 2008, the money was gone.
No matter who wins this lawsuit, it's clear the rating system needs fixing. And I don't mean a coat of paint. But there was something encouraging this week. Credit Suisse sold mortgage-backed securities without using a ratings agency. The buyers simply analyzed the bonds themselves. Imagine that.
And everything I made is trite and cheap and a waste of paint, of tape, of time.
This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Scott Jagow. I kind of skipped over a fundamental question. Why are these bundles of securities even allowed in the first place? It's just slicing and dicing in order to make more money to issue more loans that will just wind up being sliced and diced. Kai Ryssdal talked to CNBC's David Faber. He has a new book about the financial crisis called And Then the Roof Caved In.
I wanted to ask you, actually, about those securities and this entire process of securitization, the bundling and selling of these mortgages to spread that risk around, which is, in great measure, how the entire world got affected by what happened in this economy. We had Anna Schwartz on this program a number of months ago. 93-year-old woman wrote a very famous book with Milton Friedman, as I'm sure you know, called Monetary History of the United States. She said securitization was just a loser, that we shouldn't allow it, that it only really worked for the people who were doing the securitizing. Is there a place for this buying and selling of these bonds in this economy today?
I would have to believe that there still is, that the power of securitization ultimately can be a positive one in that it creates markets and creates the ability for funding to be available in areas where it might not otherwise be. Mortgage-backed securities have been around for a very long period of time and ultimately proved to be quite a positive product in many ways by providing a great deal of money to the ultimate providers of mortgages, money that they could then use again to go out and sell more mortgages. But that being said, as so often seems to be the case on Wall Street, things become perverted beyond their original intent. And that, unfortunately, seems to have happened with securitization.
As we approach the year marker of Lehman Brothers going under and Congress gets set at some point, I suppose, when it disposes of all its other business to take up the issue of regulation of the financial industry, are we coping with this crisis in a way that's going to prevent it happening again, or have we wasted the opportunity?
That, of course, is the key question that I don't think any of us are in a position to fully answer. We'll see whether the regulatory reform plans put in place or potentially going to be put in place by the Obama administration ultimately work. You know, when I look back on the crisis, I am forced to wonder whether, in fact, we would have suffered as grave a blow as many said we would if we had allowed some of these firms to ultimately fail. That's a question we'll never know the answer to. We have to take former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson's word that it would have been Armageddon, and perhaps he was right.
Perhaps. But that fear of the unknown has driven many a decision during this recession. GM and Chrysler have been yelling fire for months, but the car companies have managed to escape the theater in a calm, orderly fashion. I didn't say cheap. The taxpayers made it happen, but it was fast and organized. But since we have a significant stake in these companies, we'd best keep an eye on what they're doing to remake themselves. This was GM's first week out of bankruptcy, so we can't expect too much, but GM's been pretty active so far. Alisa Roth reported on that.
Bruce Belzowski studies the car business at the University of Michigan. He says the numbers don't matter. It's whether people buy them. He says with his expansion and hiring moves, it's easy to see why people might think the new GM is just more of the same old.
When you hear about GM hiring back executives who are supposed to be retiring, that can make people a little nervous about, are you going back to the old days?
That would be Bob Lutz he's talking about, a 77-year-old exec who retired in April and just got hired back to run marketing. GM's also set to buy back some of the troubled parts maker Delphi, which it spun off years ago. But that's not such a bad idea. John Paul McDuffie is a professor at Wharton. He says Delphi is still a major supplier to GM, and investing in the supply chain is the safest way to guarantee it.
And if the suppliers are very weak, that will make it tougher for GM to have the comeback it hopes to have.
But then again, if people don't start buying cars again, there won't be a comeback for anyone in the business.
That's true, of course, but let's assume the market picks up. What can GM do beyond slapping some new paint on old cars? That can't possibly work. Auto writer Dan Neal has some suggestions.
The problem is GM's current products aren't that great, and the cars and trucks in the pipeline were all penciled out by the highly unreformed pre-bankruptcy GM. In other words, GM has a long shadow of mediocrity to escape. To win back old customers and entice new ones, the image challenge GM needs to overcompensate. I recommend the Lexus strategy. In 1989, Toyota's luxury division launched the spectacular LS400 sedan for about $37,000. It was obvious that Lexus was losing money on the cars, but it established the brand and created legions of fans. Today, Lexus is the best-selling luxury brand in the U.S. Like Toyota, GM needs to forget about making profit in the short run and concentrate on making great cars and trucks. Any politically driven effort to repay the U.S. Treasury early will only send GM back to the miasma of short-term, cost-cut product planning that landed them in bankruptcy in the first place. With great product, all can be forgiven, even debt.
Which brings me to my final pick of the week, Walmart. Like GM, Walmart is trying to remake its image. It doesn't want to be seen as the ogre that crushes small businesses or the land-eating monster that swallows the environment. This week, Walmart announced a new environmental initiative, the likes of which we've never seen. But going back to what I said earlier, you have to wonder if this is greenwashing spin or whether it could really make a difference for the planet. Our sustainability reporter Sam Eaton looked into it.
Over the last few years, Walmart's attempt to create environmentally friendly stores has saved the company money while boosting its image as an eco-conscious retailer. But University of Arkansas sustainability professor John Johnson says the environmental benefits of those efforts are small for this reason.
Best estimates are about 90% of their environmental footprint resides outside of the company's boundaries in the supply chain.
That's why Walmart now wants its 60,000 suppliers to provide details on everything from the energy they consume to how the natural resources in their products are extracted. That information, along with how the items are used and disposed of, will be summarized on new product labels, something Andrew Hudson of the Environmental Defense Fund calls a game changer.
It's a shift in the way that we define consumerism. You know, it's no longer just about the product, you know, what it does and how much it costs. But it's pretty much now about the whole system of global commerce that goes into each product.
How Walmart determines whether its products are sustainable is another issue. Tyson Slocum with the consumer watchdog group Public Citizen says the potential for greenwashing is huge.
I'm not sure that it's appropriate for a giant retailer like Walmart to be crafting these definitions. I think we got to have an unbiased source.
Well, I don't know where you're going to find one. Everybody has a bias. Everybody wants you to see things the way they see things. Banks, rating agencies, the government, corporations. They have their buckets of paint, and they know how to splash up their best colors. But thankfully, there are people who are ready and willing to chip away at the paint and figure out what's going on underneath. And that's Marketplace After the Bell for this week. I'm Scott Jagow. We'll be back next Friday to make sense of what happened in business and the economy. Thanks for listening.
Chirp with joy like a cricket song. I am gray today, gloomy and damp like a morning fog. I am orange today, loud and messy like finger paint on the wall.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.